Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast series of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Welcome to ASA Central Line. I'm your host and editor, Dr. Adam Stryker, and this is our second subspecialty focused episode. We're trying this year to focus some of our episodes on various subspecialties of anesthesiology. We'll be continuing that throughout the year. Today, we're turning our attention to pediatrics. We actually recently did do an episode highlighting SEE in one of the articles involved pediatric airways. So this will actually be a nice follow-up to that. I can't think of two other guests that I'd rather have discussing this topic with me. One is Dr. Annery Garcia Marcinkiewicz, and the other is Dr. John Fiaggio, both from the Society of Pediatric Anesthesia, to talk specifically about pediatric airways and also the Pediatric Difficult Intubation Registry. So Drs. Fiaggio and Garcia Marcinkiewicz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Before we jump in, if you don't mind, each of you just telling our listeners a little bit about yourselves, where you practice, your roles, and how you got interested in the specific topic of pediatric airways. Let's start with Dr. Garcia Marcinkiewicz.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Annery Garcia Marcinkiewicz, and I'm a pediatric anesthesiologist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I have a special interest in taking care of patients with difficult airways, and a lot of that interest came about when I met Dr. Fiaggio when I was a fellow at CHOP, and really watching him and his expertise and learning from him was so inspirational to me to really want to learn more about how to keep patients with difficult airways safe. And I was introduced to the Pediatric Difficult Intubation Registry and just enjoyed doing research and, you know, finding out more and learning more from this fantastic registry. And currently at CHOP, I co-direct our difficult airway program. I love finding new ways to improve our practices in keeping patients with difficult airways safe, and also teaching these practices and methods to our trainees and doing refresher courses for our colleagues when we can.
Great. Dr. Fiaggio?
Yeah, that was kind of you, Dr. Marcinkiewicz. My name is John Fiaggio. I practice for about 15 years at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and currently practice at Boston Children's Hospital. I became interested in difficult airway management, especially in children, when I was a resident. As a resident, I recognized that although anesthesia was touted to be the safe specialty, these children who had difficult airways often had complications, and we often struggled to intubate them. And so early on as a resident, I made it kind of one of my missions and purposes, clinically and academically, to take care of these patients and also to learn as much as I could about outcomes in these patients. So that sparked my interest in pediatric airway management.
Well, love to talk about how the science or art of pediatric airway management has evolved. And I think probably the best way to do that is to start off by talking about the pediatric anesthesia airway database that the SPA, or Society of Pediatric Anesthesia, sponsored. So I think hopefully, as both of you talk about this, the evolution and how it's continued on and evolved over time, we'll get a better sense of just where we've come from with managing pediatric airways and where we're headed. So why don't we start off talking a little bit about the database and where it came from and how it has evolved. Dr. Fiaggio, do you mind tackling that one?
Yeah, I can dive into that. So that started early on when I became faculty at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. One of my colleagues, Mohammed Rehman, was working with electronic medical record systems and asked me to lead a special interest group within the Society of Pediatric Anesthesia to try to define what exactly is a difficult airway. How do we track that in the EMR? And that group started meeting regularly at the Society of Pediatric Anesthesia meetings and also at the American Society of Anesthesia meetings. And one of the members of the group, Peter Smook, suggested the idea that we create a registry to look at outcomes, because we all knew that the outcomes were worse than most people thought. And that sparked the idea to create this registry and to create the PD Collaborative Network, We started off with three sites, Boston Children's Hospital, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and Dallas Children's, and with the intent of conducting research, benchmarking, and quality improvement. We have now evolved over the years to more than 40 international sites that are active. I think we actually have probably close to 60 sites, but 40 are active and have accumulated, I believe the last time I checked, more than 7,000 instances of difficult airway management cases in the registry, and have published several, I think, important papers using that data.
Great. And Dr. Garcia Marcinkiewicz, do you mind telling us how the registry works?
So there's a lot of enthusiasm and many more sites that have expressed interest in joining the registry and that have joined the registry ever since the time that Dr. Fiaggio described. And basically, interested sites contact the main site in Philadelphia, which is the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And there's a robust process for capturing the data and the quality of that data and cleaning those data. So information is collected on patient demographics, such as their gender, weight, their airway exam, whether they have a genetic syndrome, the preoperative plan, the ventilation technique that's planned, the anesthetic technique, and case data are collected. So was mask ventilation possible? What airway devices were used? What medications and complications that occurred during that airway encounter? Complications are generally cataloged as non-severe versus severe complications. Non-severe complications being hypoxemia, laryngospasm, bronchospasm, immediate recognition of esophageal intubations, and severe complications being things like a pneumothorax, you know, pulmonary aspiration, delayed recognition of esophageal intubations, and cardiac arrest. And so we then look at the processes and outcomes, see what we learn. We send reports to all institutions about their performance, benchmarking, and hopefully that is a direct benefit to each site. And that's where the idea for the studies come out and, you know, help inform the next studies and improve the safety of patients.
Great. Well, Dr. Fiaggio, can you give us a little more detail on what kind of data is being mined from this registry?
Yeah. So, you know, when we started early on, it took us about 2 years to decide on the data elements that we wanted to collect. And we really had to think really carefully about the research questions we wanted to answer. Because whenever you create a registry, it has to be a balance between collecting too much information and collecting the relevant information to the question. So we spent 2 years having discussions about what was important and what things we wanted to explore. And so we collect traditional data like demographic information about the patients, but we also collect very granular data about airway management. Some of the data is not often collected in your standard airway note. We collect details about the drugs that were used, the techniques and devices that were attempted, how many attempts occurred, who performed those attempts, whether the patient had a neuromuscular blocking drug administered during that attempt. And then we looked at the types of complications that occur with each attempt and document those as well. And we categorized those complications into severe and non-severe complications, as I referred to earlier. And the interesting thing that we learned, and I was surprised by this, was that we had cases where there were 20 or more attempts at tracheal intubation. I wasn't expecting to see that, but that is not common, but it happens more often than I would have expected. Those cases are often associated with significant complications. So one of the benefits of the registry is we highlighted some of the risk factors associated with complications.
That example of 20 plus attempts, were you surprised that even if that did occur, that it was reported that way?
Yeah, one of the things that we realized, because when I was at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we'd have a research assistant actually documenting the attempts, and we defined an attempt by the entry of the laryngoscope into the pharynx till it was removed. And so you'd see what the research assistant documents, and you'd ask the team, you know, the research assistant will document 10 to 15 attempts or whatever it is. And you ask the team and they say, oh, we only made 5 good attempts, right? So there's this bias when we're documenting our own data to underestimate the data. So I think a lot of the data in the registry has this underestimation bias, especially when it's documented by the clinicians involved. So yeah, I think that's an interesting point.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, let's all talk a little bit about how the registry has changed our understanding of pediatric airways. First, let's start there. How has the understanding changed? Then let's delve into a little bit of the findings that we think our listeners should know about that has come from the registry and maybe how it informs best practices. So let's start with Dr. Garcia Marcinkiewicz. Do you mind leading us off?
So it all started with that first study that was done in 2016. At the time, there were 13 sites involved and a little over 1,000 patients in the registry. And that study really showed the scope of complications and kind of taught us a little bit about what was going on as far as the use of airway devices and some of the complications related to that in particular. So one thing that was, you know, really an important finding was that the most frequently used device for first attempt tracheal intubation, the direct laryngoscope, was the least successful device. So direct laryngoscope used 46% of the time and its first attempt success 3% compared to other devices such as the GlideScope or the fiber optic scope. So that was an important finding. Another important thing from that study was that the number of attempts matters, with each attempt at intubation increasing the odds of complication by 1.5-fold per attempt, particularly more than 2 intubation attempts, really putting that patient at risk. One of the most common non-severe complications found in the study was hypoxemia. And sometimes people say, well, a little bit of hypoxemia, what's the problem? You ventilate the patient, bag them up, and they'll be fine. But a little hypoxemia is in the pathway to cardiac arrest, which was the most common severe complication found in that first study.
You know, it's interesting because I imagine a lot of us that practice pediatric anesthesia might have guessed some of those things. But did you find that the numbers were just more staggering, or was it the concept itself surprising? The number of attempts and how the odds of complications went up so drastically?
You know, it's one of those things that you know, right? More attempts just can't be good. More bad things happen when more attempts occur. You know, your initial very orchestrated and very well thought out first attempt progressively declines as more and more attempts continue. Things get sloppier, things get messy. You know, human factors come into play, all kinds of things happen, right? But just to see those numbers and to, you know, really catalog each complication and how much risk, you know, is posed with each one of those attempts was really eye-opening.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I'll say that I think we all know clinically that, you know, making more attempts is going to be associated with more hypoxemia and more issues. What we didn't know, we didn't have actual data to support it until that study. And at the time, the reported incidence of cardiac arrest in normal healthy children coming to the operating room was about 1 in 10,000. And what we found in this population, I call them the vulnerable population, was a cardiac arrest incidence of 1 in 80 or so. So significantly different, which makes these patients, I think, require some more vigilance, attention as we take care of them. I will also say that after that first paper, I kind of categorize our subsequent work in a few categories. The first is we did some studies to assess how we ventilate and anesthetize patients using neuromuscular blocking drugs, et cetera, giving oxygen during the intubation. And then we had a category of studies that were comparative studies looking at a variety of techniques. We showed video laryngoscopy is more efficacious. And that actually, when you think about video laryngoscopy, you can think about standard blades, which have the standard Mac or Miller blade configuration, and non-standard blades, which are the more angulated ones, And we showed that most clinicians find it easier to use standard blades. We compared combined combination techniques, the flexible intubation scope through a laryngeal mask and other combinations. And then we showed that laryngeal masks are actually quite good at rescuing the impossible face mask ventilation situation. And so we've had a number of retrospective studies in those in the categories that I've mentioned. And then we've had some prospective randomized trials looking at video laryngoscopy and comparing it to direct laryngoscopy in normal children, which was a deviation from our focus on difficult airways. I think we've expanded our scope to look at normal children. And I think we're going to continue doing that to improve airway management in our patients, no matter if they have difficult airway anatomy or not.
Well, this is great. And I want to talk a little bit about what is coming next as this registry grows and as your knowledge of pediatric airways continues to grow as well. But let's go ahead and take a short patient safety break, and then we'll come back and talk about that. So please stay with me.
Hi, this is Dr. Kimberly Cantees. I'm the Vice Chair of Equity, Diversity, Inclusion at the University of Pittsburgh Department of Anesthesiology and Perioperative Medicine. We all want to live and work in a culture where we are appreciated for our contributions and feel supported. Applying the principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, to perioperative care can not only improve work productivity and satisfaction, but also patient safety and outcomes. You can start applying a DEI lens to enhance patient safety today. First, take a team approach to patient safety, including people with diverse perspectives and lived experiences, to spot biases and address barriers in creative ways. Second, implement translator services as standard of care. This can help patients feel valued and facilitate trust, communication, and satisfaction, all of which are important for patient safety. Third, access and analyze demographic data when assessing safety metrics to identify disparities that need to be addressed. Incorporating DEI principles into your everyday practice can help address patient safety challenges.
For more patient safety content, visit asahq.org/patient safety.
Well, we're back. And Dr. Garcia Marcinkovic, I'd like to hear a little bit about what you think is coming next from this registry and what we know about pediatric difficult airways. What is the potential? Where do you see this going next?
So I think we've learned a lot from the studies from the registry thus far, but there are a lot of questions that remain and areas for improvement that we have. For example, one of the studies that looked at video laryngoscopy versus direct laryngoscopy, in particular, hyperangulated blade video laryngoscopy, the glide scope video laryngoscopy compared to direct laryngoscopy in children who are difficult to intubate, found that the initial and eventual tracheal intubation success rate of the glide scope is greater than direct laryngoscopy. So that was not too surprising. Now, when you look closer at that study and you look at, well, the glide scope performed better compared to direct laryngoscopy, and that was true across all age groups in children. However, the magnitude of that effect was a little less so for those children less than 10 kilos, those typically under 1 year old. So you might ask, well, why might that be? And there could be a few reasons for that. Maybe those patients in the younger age group need oxygenation during their tracheal intubation attempts. Additionally, maybe there's some room for improvement in how we use hyperangulated blade video laryngoscopy. And subsequent to that, there have been a few other studies that have suggested that, including a study that came after that in the PD registry, one that Dr. Fiaggio alluded to, the one looking at hyperangulated blade video laryngoscopy compared to standard blade video laryngoscopy. And that study found that in patients less than 5 kilos, standard blade video laryngoscopy had greater tracheal intubation success rates. A few other studies, even outside of the registry, have found similar things. And so a lot of this is suggesting that our hyperangulated blade video laryngoscopy skills could use a little bit more improvement in the younger, more vulnerable population. So that's another study that is in development. Finally, oxygenation. Oxygenation in our most youngest vulnerable patients, you know, should peri-intubation oxygenation be the standard? That's another question there too. And then from the ventilation technique studies, looking at when neuromuscular blockade is used for initial tracheal intubation versus when it's not, and spontaneous ventilation, what are our rates of complications? Well, that study found that spontaneous ventilation has greater complications compared to controlled ventilation with muscle relaxant and controlled ventilation without muscle relaxant. Initially, making one think, well, maybe it's the muscle relaxant that's protective. And when you look closer, you find that the differential in complications between those with spontaneous ventilation technique and those with controlled ventilation technique is actually related to airway reactivity. Another PD study after that found that when you compare sedation to general anesthesia for initial tracheal intubation, that about 27% of cases that are managed with sedation have to be converted to general anesthesia in order to complete the intubation. All of this is suggesting that anesthetic depth is an area for quality improvement in pediatric patients. And it's understandable. We might hesitate to give too much medication. We don't want to lose the airway. It's a big risk, but we can possibly improve how we assess anesthetic depth. And that's another study coming up.
One of the interesting things that has evolved over the years is the gold standard for the management of a difficult airway seems to be evolving. Many of my colleagues reach for a video laryngoscope for their first attempt rather than the fiber optic bronchoscope. So I was trained in the era of the fiber optic bronchoscope, and I've always thought of it as the gold standard. But the question is video laryngoscopy performing just as well? And given that we have this multi-center registry, I think it gives us the opportunity to do a randomized trial where we randomize patients to fiber optic bronchoscopy versus video laryngoscopy for their first attempt to get some information about the various success rates. I mean, I think many clinicians find it much easier to use the video laryngoscope. It's more readily available. But I do wonder if losing the fiber optic bronchoscopy skills will be a detriment to our patients. So it's another question that we're going to explore.
Well, this is a great segue because I did want to delve a little bit more into the debate between direct laryngoscopy and video laryngoscopy. How do we reconcile what we see in databases or retrospective trials or even prospective trials with how each individual practitioner might be more comfortable with a certain technique? And this is something I've heard time and time again, and I'm not dismissing it. I think there's a lot of practitioners that feel this way. In my hands, we've all heard that, or I'm so much better with a fiber optic bronchoscope, or I trained with a retromolar approach and I'm better with a direct laryngoscope. So for me, it's more successful. How do we reconcile those two thought processes?
Yeah, that's a great one. I think we are always going to feel more comfortable with a certain approach, and I don't discount that. I'm very supportive of people using the technique they think they're most facile with. I will say that whenever new technology comes in, there's always going to be some resistance to that new technology, even if it's safer because we're more comfortable with the old technology. And so that's always going to be an element of this. I do think we have to look at the aggregate data and use that to guide our quality improvement, even in experienced hands with direct laryngoscopy. You often need help from others. And we are fallible human beings. Sometimes we see things that are actually not there. That is in many domains. There's a great video that shows a couple of people bouncing a basketball and they ask them to count the number of bounces and a gorilla walks by and most people miss it. There's that change blindness. So you may think you're looking at the glottis, but you could be looking at something else. You may need someone to assist you by giving you external laryngeal manipulation to get a better view. They can help you better if you're using a video laryngoscope. So on all fronts, I think having that tool from a patient perspective is better. Do video laryngoscope blades stop functioning? Does the light not function at a critical moment? Yes, those things do happen. And I do think we need to teach direct laryngoscopy. I just think you can teach direct laryngoscopy better with a video laryngoscope than with a direct laryngoscope.
I would also add to that, I think we need to rehearse more, right? I think that airway management is not a static thing. It's a dynamic thing. And I think we're responsible for knowing how to use each device and perform each technique. And so, you know, someone once told me that the best players are not the ones who play the game more. They're the ones who practice more, right? And so we need to benefit from practicing some of these airway skills in, you know, with simulation and in airway labs and looking at airway management as something that we can go ahead and do during 10-minute, you know, OR turnovers and just do some drills, right? Get our hands warm with some of these airway devices that we infrequently use so that we're prepared when the moment comes. And that is the best tool to use for the patient at 2 a.m.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's the best analogy, but do you feel like the ultrasound used for vascular access is a good analogy? At first, people might have been resistant because they don't need it. They're used to doing it without it. But now I would think that most people would agree that there's a much higher success rate by using ultrasound for vascular access across the board.
That's a great example, Dr. Strike. I think I remember early on in my career, many cases that were canceled because the team was unable to obtain vascular access. I've not seen that happen in years since we started using ultrasound. It's just been a game changer. And so I think that is a great analogy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about limitations of the registry, Dr. Viaggio. What are they?
Yeah, I like to tell the story about World War II when the French planes were coming back with bullet holes and the French were losing a lot of planes during the war. And they started looking at the planes that returned and they had the idea to look at the areas where the, you know, the wings of the planes had a lot of holes in them. And they wanted to protect the wings and add armor to the wings. And an astute statistician, mathematician, Dr. Wald, pointed out that the planes that didn't come back were probably hit in the midsection, and actually they shouldn't protect the wings, they should protect the opposite areas. And so it made the point that they had a selection bias. They were looking at the planes that made it back. And so I think whenever you have these kinds of registries and data collection, you run the risk of having a selection bias. People may document cases they remember more vividly. And so that's a limitation. I also think that whenever you have a registry, the collection of data can be a problem. Entry of data in a timely fashion, incorrect data. And we do a really good job of going through every entry and cleaning that data, but sometimes you can still miss some things. And then the longevity of the registry. You know, right now we have close to 8,000 cases of difficult intubations. And so collecting additional data is unlikely to change much. But right now, I think the registry is fueling our quality improvement efforts. But we're using the initial data in the registry to guide future studies, which is the important thing. So, you know, those are some of the limitations of the registry. And then obviously there's the cost issue, which, you know, has always comes up with these kind of efforts.
And Dr. Garcia-Marcinkiewicz, if individuals want to sign up or inquire about the difficulty with participating, difficulty meaning the effort, I should say, in submitting data to the registry if they're interested in participating, is it straightforward? Is it time consuming?
If they're interested in participating, they can contact us. We have a fantastic research coordinator. Her name is Paula Hughes. She is wonderful. She will guide them through the process and make it as easy as possible to, you know, have them enter their data and get it to us at the central site at CHOP.
Great. And along those lines, for listeners whose interest has been piqued by this conversation, and they're saying to themselves, boy, I'd love to delve more into this information that this registry has produced or some of the recommendations, what would be the best mechanism for them to obtain that? Is there a site or a collection of information that they could go find, or a primer, pediatric airways, that has been the result of the information obtained from the registry?
Yeah, the PD registry has a website hosted on the SPA, and you can get a lot of information about the registry, some of the members, some of the studies that have been done through that mechanism. And of course, feel free to reach out to any of us. We're happy to help and, you know, help get people engaged into this work.
And you can access that from the SPA website. So that's pedsanesthesia.org. And one last question before I let both of you go. I know you're both heavily involved with the SPA. Can you talk a little bit about how you see the role of this important subspecialty society and how it plays with the ASA and why it's important to be a member of both? Dr. Fiaggio, let's start with you.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of our organizations. I think they really foster development, whether you're an academic clinician or someone in private practice. You will gain benefit from being a member of the SPA and the ASA. It is really where this registry idea was born. You know, as a member of the Society of Pediatric Anesthesia, I can tell you that a lot of people's careers have blossomed in the society. Not only have careers blossomed in the society, we've had lots of friendships and lifelong connections that have helped us and supported growth of many individuals in the society. And I'll just mention a few of the special interest groups in the Society of Pediatric Anesthesia that I think are wonderful. There's a Women's Empowerment and Leadership Initiative that was spearheaded by Dr. Jenny Lee, who's at Hopkins, that has a goal of mentoring the next generation of and current generation of women leaders. There's an educational special interest group, and Dr. Joseph Sisk has worked on these individual case guides that tell you details of various types of pediatric anesthesia cases accessible on the pediatric anesthesia website. Matthew Kynes leads the Global Health SIG. There's a disaster preparedness SIG that Mira Gangadharan spearheads. There's a craniofacial registry that's taken a very similar path to what we have done with the airway, Dr. Paul Stricker. Dr. Allison Fernandez has spearheaded the Society for Pediatric Anesthesia Improvement Network, Spain, looking at outcomes in children undergoing painful surgeries. And point of care ultrasound, sustainability, the PD Collaborative, Agnes Hunyadi is the current chair of that, of the PD Collaborative. So lots of opportunities to really grow. And then attending the meetings, both this SPA and the ASA have workshops and lectures. And I'll tell you, my practice has evolved over the years from things I've heard in lectures, invaluable experience. And finally, the social connections. The largest study on longevity, the Harvard study, I think is called, looks at the things that are associated with longevity. And it's not your cholesterol. It's not your blood pressure. It's not any of these things that we traditionally think. It's your social connections. And these societies are really opportunities for us to make those social connections and that support that we really need in anesthesia today, given the high amounts of burnout that we see across the country. So that's my case for why you should be a member of our societies. And I hope to see all of you who are listening, please come up to me and let's have a conversation at any of the meetings because I'm always there.
Excellent. Dr. Garcia Marcinkovic, what do you think?
Yes, I'll tell you this. The SPA and ASA has been where I've met some of the best friends that I currently have. You know, people who practice in different institutions that I might have otherwise not met. And these friendships have just strengthened throughout the years, you know, collegial relationships, exchange of ideas. You know, we all look forward to these meetings happening to, you know, talk about what we're doing, learn from each other, catch up, see what people are up to. And it's really just wonderful and a ton of fun.
Well, I certainly echo those sentiments greatly. And I just want to thank you both for joining us today on this episode of Centraline to talk about this topic. It's an important topic. It's a fascinating one. And the work you both do, along with everyone else, putting together and collating the data and coming up with the studies and just producing the information from this registry is so valuable. And so thank you both for not only all the work you do, but for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having us on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And for our listeners, as we mentioned before, if you're interested in any of the information discussed, you can check out the Society for Pediatric Anesthesia website at www.pedsanesthesia.org. And please tune again next time to Centraline. Take care.
Tap into the collective experience of the ASA community for real conversation, meaningful connection, and valuable support. Find your voice at community.asahq.org. Subscribe to Centraline today wherever you get your podcasts. or visit asahq.org/podcasts for more.